Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting but not streaming through our studios in New York City, and I'd like to welcome you. And if you have any problem reaching us, you can always call a number live over your cell phone, hard line, or computer and listen Monday to Friday, noon to 1 Eastern Standard Time. Let me give you that number. Please write it down. 712-775-6850. 712-775-6850. But we have found 95% of the people listen to the program over the archives. Let me give you the archive number. 701-719-9976. 701-719-9976. Today we're going to continue with our conversations with remarkable minds. Professor Rupert Sheldrake talking about the science and spiritual practices that benefits us on a physical and mental health level. And also, time permitting, a commentary on what's wrong with reporting about the journalist for the Washington Post, a Saudi national, who it's alleged was tortured for 7 minutes, chopped up, beheaded, and by the way, chopped up, his fingers torn off, and a bone saw used to cut through his legs. Why was he still alive? 15 people on an assassination team from Saudi Arabia, including the Saudi ruler, who's not the king, that's his father, but he's taken over all the power. He's only 32 years old, and they work for him. So why do I feel that how we're approaching this is absolutely asinine? A commentary. But we always start with the latest on health and healing. This is from the Heart Disease Research Foundation, and it shows that caprylic acid, caprylic, C-A-P-R-Y-L-I-C, you can find it in coconut oil, kills persistent candida. Now, caprylic acid, which is a natural compound, has been observed to penetrate and eradicate persistent candida biofilms. These are the yeast that are in the anus, the vagina, even in the throat. And they can be really problematic. Well, a recent peer-reviewed study published in Frontiers of Microbiology concluded that a combination of caprylic acid and peptic acid, that's a water-soluble fiber found in almost all fruits and vegetables, completely eliminated pathogenic biofilms within an hour of exposure. Moreover, this reaction was isolated to only toxic cells, meaning not a single healthy cell was left harmed. So that's important. Now, you can also get caprylic acid in that bitter-tasting grapefruit seed. And it does a good job getting rid of a lot of yeast infections. And especially people who have overgrowth because of taking too many antibiotics. And caprylic acid is a very powerful natural antifungal. It works best when I believe that if you use it with quercetin and vitamin C and olive leaf extract. That's where I'm able to help people kill off the most yeast infections in their body. But you could also use it with oregano oil and garlic if you dilute it, because oregano oil by itself is just too hard for most people. You have to dilute it about 20 to 1, 20 parts water to 1 part oregano oil. Separately from that, from Tufts University, published in the British Medical Journal today, once again, I mentioned yesterday another study on the omega-3 fatty acids found in seafood. Well, this one is linked to healthier aging. So they measured the amount of the omega-3 fatty acids in people's blood. And they found that the more you have, the healthier you're going to age. Well, let's just pull back for a moment and look at the larger picture. With populations across the world living longer, there's a growing focus on healthy aging. And that's good. A meaningful lifespan without major chronic disease and with good physical and mental function, that's what most of us want. And previous studies have suggested omega-3 polyunsaturated fatty acids derived from seafood and plants can be beneficial on the body and promote healthy aging. And this is probably one of the best of these. This was through the School of Nutrition Science and Policy at Tufts University in Boston. So one more reason to make sure you're getting your either sea-based omega-3 fatty acids, your fish oils, or your plant-based. They both are beneficial in the body. And talking about aging, because a lot of people are not aware of that everyone historically died young. That's a myth. And I read an article by Dr. Christine Cave, C-A-V-E, in Eon, where she talks about the idea that how did we come up with this idea that everyone in historical times lived very short lives, 20, 21 years of age? She found documents going back to the 24th century BCE. And there was an Egyptian writer who wrote verses about the disintegrations of old age. And the ancient Greeks classed old age among the divine curses. And on their tombstones, attest to survival past the age of 80. And ancient artworks and figurines also depict elderly people stooped, flabby, and wrinkled. That's because they didn't have the knowledge we have today. But hey, I found people who in all eras were living in their 80s and 90s. In fact, as a hobby once, I was in dietetic school at the time, and we were doing original papers. And I wanted to compare the ages of the signers of the Declaration of Independence to the persons today and see what was the difference. And then I went back and I found old menus and of what they were eating in taverns and what they were drinking and whether they were vigorous or exercised. And I found that the average age of the signers of the Declaration of Independence was older than members of Congress today. They were living longer lives. And a lot of them, like Benjamin Franklin, believed in vitalism or the vitalist principles. Bring into your body and bring into your mind that which keeps it vital. Now think today that we don't have vitalism. It's nowhere in our nomenclature because we think that as long as, and I just saw this, I mean, I spoke with probably 50% of the people at my reunion just about 2 months ago in Parkersburg, and I ask them, what are you doing? What's your projects or plans? Do you have any goals? And they looked at me as if, why am I asking this question? They don't have to do anything. They put in their 20 years, 25 years, 30 years. They're retired. Many have been retired for 20 years. And so they don't do a whole lot of anything. And they're not exercising. Their diet's the same as it's always been. They watch television, they're up on the internet somewhat, and they keep to a small social circle. Where's the vitalism in that? Where's their opportunity to grow? There's not. You have to challenge yourself. And people don't want to challenge themselves. We're a nation that's fatigued mentally, spiritually, and physically. So when you look back throughout history, you'll see that people easily lived over 80 thousands of years ago. Go back and look at the Greek philosopher, the Roman philosophers, and you'll see this. Look at people in Mesopotamia, read the literature. So studies on traditional people who live far away from modern medicine's markets, such as Tanzania's Hadza or Brazil's Yamamati, have demonstrated that most likely age to at least in their 70s. Now, mind you, they have no hospitals, no medicines. They're not taking any vitamins. They don't have any meditation classes, stress classes, or yoga classes. They don't have any Reiki grandmasters who became a seventh-degree Reiki grandmaster after studying for 3 hours some weekend. Well, what a nonsense. But they don't have any of that. They just live close to nature. Family is very important. There's a great deal in trust. They have an idea of their lives. They're not dealing with angst and identity crisis, and they're living longer than the average American frequently. And by the way, the average American's lifespan in the last 30 years is declining, especially among women. Why? Well, simple. We have In the developed world, the most unhealthy lifestyles, the most intentional stress, meaning we bring it upon ourselves, and we are dying quicker. We've lost 2.5 years off our lifespan. Do you know the people now, the longest-lived people in the world per nation? Spain. They passed Japan. Now, have you been to Spain? It's a beautiful country. It would be like visiting Arizona at the higher altitude, up around Flagstaff. There are places that are like little oases, especially around the seaports, like San Sebastian, but otherwise, a lot of it's desert. Still, it's beautiful, but they don't rush out to do anything. There's an evenness to their life, a calmness, a measured sense of doing it with pleasure, not anxiety. They don't have a stopwatch to do every task and then be judged by it. Plus, they have a good, not a perfect diet by any means, but they have a good diet. They have lots of fruits and vegetables and gourds, beans and nuts and seafood. They do eat meat, and they eat all kinds of meat. One restaurant I went in, they specialize, very high end, they specialize in pig's heads. Whoa. And boy, you can smell it half a block away, but that's an acquired taste. The poor pig had to suffer for someone who didn't need to eat the head, but again, stupidity reigns everywhere. In any case, so understand, we are suffering not from any normal aging disease, because there is no disease normal to aging. We are suffering from the cumulative effects of wrong choices. So we live by this myth. Also, to the epidemiologists who are looking, and the anthropologists digging through graves and bones and literature to find the meaning of these people's lives, you're starting off with a flawed concept, and that is, all the historical records show that there was a very high infant mortality. Babies died. A lot of mothers died from infections at birth. So an average is, you take the person that lived the longest lifespan, 90, and the person that died at birth, well, then you'd come up with, you know, an average of 45. And that's how we had these skewed numbers that, oh, in America, the average lifespan in 1900 was 29. No, it wasn't. Averages don't mean a damn thing. They're worthless. They're garbage science. All you have to do is look at the... It'd be like saying we found 21,000 UFO reports to be false. Oh, we did find one that was legitimate. Hello, then you prove they exist. Your proof doesn't come from what is a negative. Your proof comes from a positive. If every single mechanical scientist in the world said the body cannot tolerate going faster than a four-minute mile, and Bannister broke it in 3:59, then he proved it. They were wrong. He was right. You now have to readjust and recalibrate all your thinking. The trouble is, we're not doing that in medicine and biological sciences. We're not doing that. We're still using outdated modems of the wrong input. So I just want to share that with you, because a lot of people are confused about how long we should live. You're going to live as long as you've conditioned your body with the right input, mentally, spiritually, and physically and environmentally. About 2 months ago, Richard Gale and I published an article. I think we've done around 12 or 13. We have about 100 yet to go on Wikipedia. And we're saving the best for last, by the way. So thank you, all of your whistleblowers and people inside and people who've been close to Jimmy Wales, for sharing documentation and details. All of it will be put in articles. But we've blown a feather in their direction compared to what's coming. That I promise you. So in any case, we did an article on the legitimacy of homeopathy. They said it's quackery. They only have their beliefs. We have science using the peer-reviewed literature. It works. Here's the latest. And which institution says that homeopathy works? Quote, homeopathic therapies found more effective at treating psychiatric disorders than conventional medicine alone. Whoa. Who says? Some quacks? University of France, the Pasteur Institute. Institute of Pasteur. That's correct. Published in the British Medical Journal, Complementary and Alternative Medicine. Quote, more cases of psychiatric disorders such as anxiety and depression are being diagnosed and treated worldwide. Conventional treatments for these diseases include the use of psychotropic and antidepressant drugs. However, there are also general practitioners that prescribe the use of homeopathic, either in addition to or as a complete alternative to conventional medicine. A study on this reveals that patients prescribed homeopathic remedies experienced significant improvements over patients that were only given conventional care. How about that? One more, one of the most respected institutions in the world, Institut Pasteur, is saying homeopathy works. This is an unusual study. This is a study dealing with cesarean. And here's what they say. C-sections are sometimes inevitable and often necessary to save lives of mother and baby. However, elective C-sections have skyrocketed in the last 30 years, increasing respiratory problems, obesity, and altering a baby's microbiome, influencing allergies, asthma later in life. That's the new evidence. Because what happens is when you do a major procedure like cesarean section on a baby, the mother's feeling the trauma and the pain, and it's a major issue. And that epigenetically is trapped into the baby from the mother. So that means the baby then is going to end up with medical complications based upon the C-section delivery. And this was a Danish study of 34,000 deliveries and found that cesarean sections, quote, double the risk of becoming obese children. Quote, women who have their first child by cesarean are more likely to have placenta-related problems in their second pregnancy, and there's also problems with infections and microbiomes. And the preceding study was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, our most respected scientific institution. Also, remember we did a study on showing the legitimacy of the historical traditional Chinese medicine? They call it quackery. We say, to the contrary, you're giving us your opinions, with in my opinion, or their opinions are worth nothing. I want the science. So this is the Chinese Journal of Natural Medicine, a peer-reviewed journal, done at the University, Beijing University of Chinese Medicine. Sinai powder, that's S-I-N-I, which is a traditional herbal formula used in traditional Chinese medicine, shown to have potent antidepressive effects. So for people who are depressed, you now have a natural alternative to antidepressants. And that's good. Again, it's called Sinai, S-I-N-I, and it's used in traditional Chinese medicine. So if you've been, and they tested it, it was as good as antidepressants, but with antidepressants you have all kinds of side effects. So something to think about. And finally, from Isfahan University Medical School in Iran, combining garlic and lemon significantly reduces blood pressure and your total cholesterol. So combining garlic and lemon juice slashes your total cholesterol levels in people with elevated blood lipids, as well as improves your blood pressure profile. And that was published in the International Journal of Preventive Medicine. And by the way, they also found that raw honey and garlic and lemon juice together was also terrific for your immune system. So that's good. And, oh, one last one. This is from Kukmin University in South Korea. They found that high vitamin and mineral consumption is linked to a delayed biological aging. This was a 10-year study, and they found that if you're eating mineral-rich and vitamin-rich foods throughout early adulthood, it could help delay the biological aging process substantially. And this was published in the Journal of Human Nutrition and Dietetics. So once again, good diet, taking vitamins and minerals, allows you to live a longer life. One last one from University of Otago, which is New Zealand. A short walk, and I've told you this many times, a short walk after meals can provide an important tool for managing diabetes. So you eat your food, then you go for a short walk, and it controls your blood sugar. That's good news. That's the latest from around the world, always the best we can find for you. We're going to take a break. Come right back with a commentary. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. Right now, we're going to go into some other topics, including our environmental segments. And this is from the Los Alamos National Laboratory. They're saying that the Arctic is greening, and that's causing an additional thawing of the permafrost that in turn boosts runoff. So, in effect, it's saying that shrubs trap snow, creating permanently thawed zones that destroy permafrost and create pathways for increased water and carbon flow. And that's a new collaborative study. And so in lay language, it just means that we can better understand how the far north tundra and vast permafrost systems work. So it's melting. It's speeding up. And the fact that where they've never had green before, now things are greening. By the way, we're also hearing that from other countries like Switzerland, where now the type of greening that had gone down in the valleys is creeping up the mountainsides, up around 8,000, 10,000, 12,000 feet, something you would normally not find, not in Switzerland. Now that's the new norm. Unfortunately, when this happens, when you get too much heat, you also get a lot of insects. And you get insects that are going to be a problem. You're also going to get beetles. That's going to be a problem. And you're going to start to release massive amounts of permafrost. When the tundra that has been frozen for thousands of years, when that thaws, that's trapping a massive amounts of methane. And as that methane begins to burp out by the trillions, it's going to cause global warming to accelerate faster than anyone ever anticipated. You've been listening to a series that Richard Gale and myself have been writing and researching for more than 10 years. We have a major new article coming out in the next few days on this. I'll be presenting it next week, part two. And part one, we looked at the causes. Now we're looking at how bad will it get and how quickly, and then what are the solutions. And one of the biggest problems is that normally the sun comes down and hits the ice on mountains or over the ocean, like the Arctic Ocean, and bounces harmlessly back into the atmosphere. That's a good thing. But now that it's heating up, heating faster and to a higher degree than it's been in hundreds of thousands of years, then the snow that once was there is not. So it's hitting the mountain. When you hit the rock, you heat the rock. The rock then starts to radiate that heat further down the rock slope, which then accelerates the melting. So instead of having, let's say, a six-month period where snow melted, now it's doing it in a matter of weeks or a few months. That's causing massive amounts of wasted water because it can't be used properly in the irrigation system nor to refill the aquifer system. In fact, if anything, it just causes flooding. But then in the ocean, it goes down because there's no ice in much of the ocean in the summertime. It goes down, hits the bottom, warms it up, and now that frozen bottom of the ocean, the Arctic Ocean, warms up, opens up, and uncountable numbers of methane bubbles come up. And every one of those bubbles is warming the air. And because often scientists use mathematical models that in and of themselves are not accurate in environmental science, they're not looking at on-the-ground situations. For example, no one predicted a category, for all intents and purposes, a category 5. It was just 1 mile an hour under category 5, so it was officially a category 4. But for the people up in Mexico City, in the beach community of northern Florida, and for Panama City up in northern Florida, it was a tsunami. It devastated them. The water surge was up to 15 feet. The wind was at 156 miles an hour, and the rain was torrential, and it was hard-hitting. So it just decimated it. So where are the mathematical models that predicted that? They're not there. A year ago, a Category 4 at the same mile per hour hit southern Florida and worked its way up from the Keys, clear up through up to around Tampa. Then it dissipated down. But it had a 400-plus mile width, so the entire state of Florida was covered. But where it really hit and did the most damage was on the west coast of Florida. This has nothing to do with red tide and the pollution and the devastation of the fish and the pollution of the fish and the people living on the canals that no longer have the value of the aesthetics of living on a canal, which for decades, for actually for generations in Naples and Fort Myers and Port St. Lucie and Sarasota, and going clear down to Marco Island, if you could walk out the back door, get into your boat, and in 5 minutes, you're in the Gulf of Mexico, and you could enjoy yourself. That's all now problematic. Now, people said, okay, it'll clear up. No, it won't. It won't, because the amount of rain coming into Florida, the amount of rain filling Okeechobee, and then they have to open up the sluice gates and let that water, excess water out, that's going to the East Coast and West Coast simultaneously, and that's rich in nitrogen, which you don't want, and phosphate fertilizer, which you don't want, and now you get your algae blooms, kills off, and creates dead zones, and we've seen hundreds of millions of dead fish, and hundreds of manatees dead, and even dolphins dead, because it's 40 miles wide. So all, for all intents and purposes, it destroyed that. So that's one problem. Now you've got another problem. You've got how many new storms will come at a Category 4 or 5, or even possibly a Category 6, which they're predicting. And what would happen if a Category 6 hit Miami? Because with Miami, you've got all of Dade County, you've got up to, you've got Fort Lauderdale, Boca, West Palm Beach, and then below that, you've got Homestead and the Keys. Well, one storm's going to hit it all, and you're going to look at about $1 trillion, that's with a T, $1 trillion, in damages. So let's just say that the federal government says, all right, we'll pick up the tab. The insurance companies are not going to. So who's going to pay to rebuild people's individuals' homes when the insurance companies are saying that we're only paying a small percentage? My home, they said we're paying 3% initially, 3%. Well, we immediately, I sued and we went in, and now they're having to pay me the proper amount. But most people don't have those policies, and therefore they're just devastated. What if they've got a mortgage on the house? You think anyone's going to forgive your mortgage because it was destroyed? Not at all. No, these are number crunchers. They're looking at how much will insurance devastation cost the company, and will they stop insuring, or will they increase the policies, or will they increase the policies and limit the coverage? Either way, they're going to stay profitable, because profit is their number one idea, not you being able to get your house to where you can live in it again. But here's a larger question. Based upon this study about the Arctic greening, then extrapolate that going south. That means you're going to have hotter temperatures in Canada. Now, Canada is a country about the same size as the United States as far as actual landmass. They don't have the total mileage, because we have Florida, and which is a long state, and Texas. But they have a huge, larger than the United States' breadbasket, where they grow and have historically enormous amounts of wheat and other grains, and they have orchards. What's going to happen now? We're not talking about the future, when it's 3 degrees hotter than what it would be. You wouldn't notice it. You'd walk outside, it says 85, but it's, you know, it's maybe it's 88 as far as ground temperature. You could adapt to that. You do now. But the soil can't. It takes a long time for the soil and its germination process when seeds are planted to adapt. So there are going to be less grains grown. Means less bread. Means instead of exporting crop, they're going to have to use it internally. All right, so a year or two goes by and people start seeing the cost of food go up exponentially. If people are already in food insecure, how are they going to afford these additional pass-alongs? Because everyone's going to pass along to the consumer. So you're looking at the consequences of what happens when nature runs amok, and it's doing it now. And this latest study from Los Alamos National Laboratory is just one of hundreds of studies, hundreds, showing here's another piece of the puzzle, another piece of the puzzle. And most people are just overwhelmed. And especially if they've been hit and feel helpless. Right now, the government did not prepare properly for this, because if we really wanted to help people who were in disaster-prone areas, California, New Mexico, Arizona, Texas, Florida, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, North and South Carolina, over to Colorado, Kansas, up to Idaho, North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, Washington State, all of those have had unique, exceptional environmental disasters in the last 24 months. The worst in the country's history. So what do? Send in the Red Cross to give you some sandwiches and coffee and a blanket? That's not an answer. Here's a suggestion. I believe that we should immediately declare a worldwide emergency, because what's happening here is happening all over the world, and frequently at a worse outcomes. We should stop spending money on the military-industrial complex, because almost 80% of it is wasted. Instead, we should build in every community within 100 miles, because if you know there's a disaster coming, most people can get 100 miles to a place, and above ground, out of concrete and rebar, so nothing's going to destroy it, no fire, no wind, no hurricane, no flooding. And in that, based upon the number of people in the county, and figuring approximately 20% of the people in the county may use it, then you make it for that amount of people. It might be 1 million square feet. But in there, you would have lodging for families, not just mats on the floor, but actual rooms where a family could live, and single people as well. You'd have a group of mental health counselors to help people with the stress of loss. You'd have a full medical clinic, so anything that needed to be dealt with because of people's physical conditions, it would be like a hospital. You would also have a central diner where people go in 3 times a day, and there'd be healthy, fresh foods prepared for them, so they're not going to be malnourished and not going to be eating box food. And also there'd be additional planning services where people could then be helping who work there, helping people relocate to where there's a family member someplace, helping them if they don't have transportation, or if they do have transportation, how to get there. So that's what we should be doing. Because right now what happens is this. I'll give you a good example. This was in Louisiana about 1.5 years ago. The worst flooding in Louisiana history happened in the last 2 years. 53,000 homes were adversely affected or destroyed by the hurricane. Here's the problem. The people did not have flood insurance because it almost never floods in these areas. It does down by the bayous and down by the Gulf, but not further upstate. The flooding caught a lot of people by surprise, especially where those that might have basement, because they didn't have the means of getting the water out of the basement. So what you do is you say to a person, your home is functionally destroyed, you don't have insurance on it, the damage that was done is not covered under your policy, and the person says, where am I supposed to live? Person just shrugs her shoulders. I don't know. What am I supposed to do? I don't have any money. I had a mortgage on this place. We were stressed just paying the mortgage. Now I sold the mortgage and I can't go in the property. It's been condemned. Because at a certain point, just like with Katrina, and I was there. I actually was there and saw with my own eyes, went on to places where people were outside and they were crying because their home had been condemned. And so they had no place to go. And at the other end, it should have been condemned. These places were structurally unsound and they were loaded with black mold. So if someone spent any time at all in those places, they're going to end up with respiratory infections or bloodborne diseases that could kill them. So we have to plan for that. So we have to start planning where best in America, in different areas that are sustainable, that are not in a hurricane alley or a place where there's tidal flooding or fires constantly, like in California. Where else could we help people move to? And there's where we have to do what the Chinese did. The Chinese did it. They built 100 phantom cities holding over 200 million people. We could do the same thing in the United States and therefore help a person get through a period of time until they came back on their feet. If we were really coming from moral and spiritual values, I believe we would do it in a heartbeat. That's a solution, at least a realistic short-term solution to our problems. And we could employ a lot of people in doing this with a living wage. We have on the line right now from the United Kingdom, I believe he's in the United Kingdom, Dr. Rupert Sheldrake. And Dr. Sheldrake is a British biochemist and plant physiologist who has experimented with innovative field theory in plants and animals, including humans, to account for the causative formation of the deeper structures of biological development and collective consciousness. He has been a fellow at Cambridge University, a Frank Knox Fellow at Harvard University, a research fellow of the British Royal Society. His research has included efforts to reach a greater understanding of memory, perception, cognition, and debate over consciousness. And over the past several decades, Rupert developed his theory of morphic resonance and morphogenic fields. And he's written extensively on morphogenic theory since the publication of A New Science in Life back in 1981. His most recent book is Science and Spiritual Practice, Transformative Experiences and Their Effects on Our Bodies, Brains, and Health, which takes a scientific look at religion and the human idea and practice that it is based upon. His website is sheldrake.org. Nice to have you with us today.
Good to be with you again, Gary.
The religious and spiritual landscape in the United States and Europe is changing dramatically and for the worst, in my opinion. I just did a commentary about how, as a society, we do not condemn our trading partners when they're committing genocide against innocent people. But when one person gets killed, that's the only thing that we focus on with such monotheistic focus that nothing else seems to matter. And interest in affiliation is declining rapidly, yet people still have a strong curiosity about human facility to make better choices, including those associated with mystical traditions. But also, they cannot understand everything based upon a scientific rationalism alone. A lot of people, even including physicians, are looking beyond their traditional rationalist reductionistic view of the body and healing disease. And this includes precognitive insight, personal experiences that seem to awaken our senses of another reality, some mystical-like experiences we might have in nature, near-death experiences, among others. What the earlier religious traditions offer is a technology for having and sustaining these experiences. And a person does not need to be affiliated with any religion to experiment with them, nor to have such experiences. In fact, there are very empirical reasons for why these practices work and have been shown to make people feel happier and healthier. For example, tens of millions of people now meditate regularly. We do this because we observe and experience and get positive feedback from other people that it changed how they feel. So to begin, share some of the more current scientific research that confirms the positive impact that meditation and other spiritual practices can have on our lives. The forum is yours.
Well, thanks, Gary. That's a very comprehensive introduction. let's start with meditation. I deal with seven practices in the book: meditation, gratitude, connecting with nature, relating to plants, singing and chanting, rituals, and pilgrimage. Actually, it might be best to start with gratitude, because this, I think, is one of the most fundamental spiritual practices. And it's now been shown very clearly by positive psychologists, the school of psychology that studies what makes people happy as opposed to miserable. Positive psychologists have found that many happy people are grateful people. So the question then arose, are they grateful because they're happy, or are they happy because they're grateful? And they did experiments in which people did, some groups of randomly selected participants did gratefulness exercises and others didn't. And they found that the people who did gratefulness exercises, even quite brief ones, like making a list of things they felt grateful for in the previous week, were measurably happier for days. And this simple practice of gratefulness, which has been part of all cultures, all traditions, all religions, is something anyone can do. And one simple suggestion I make too at the end of each chapter for practices people can take up is giving thanks before a meal, which is, after all, a very traditional practice in most traditions, but many people in the secular world have just given up on this sort of practice, but it's easy to get it back again. Well, that's one. Do you want me to go on with something about meditation?
Yes, please.
Okay, well, I can't go through them all with all the evidence. I mean, I can, but let's just do one more and then see where we want to go. Meditation has been investigated scientifically since at least the 1970s. Both kinds of meditation that are common in the modern world are the mantra-based or meditation where people silently repeat a mantra or a phrase or a word. And the other kind of mindfulness meditation is where people focus on the breathing, on sensations in the body without a mantra. Anyway, those are both very common forms of meditation, and both of them have similar effects physiologically. They bring about a relaxation response. They reduce blood pressure. They reduce heart rate. They reduce the symptoms of stress caused by anxiety and worry. And as a result, people who do these regularly tend to sleep better and are less prone to depression and anxiety. Also, there are changes that happen in the brain revealed by fMRI scans and EEGs. A reduction in the activity of the default mode network, which is about rumination and worry, increase in areas associated with feeling calm. That's not surprising, since that's how people feel. And so I think that the evidence for the benefits of meditation, physiologically and in terms of brain change, are very well documented. There are literally hundreds of papers on this in peer-reviewed journals. The bit that's perhaps controversial is what you make of this. Some people who meditate think that what's happening is just changes inside the brain, changes in neural circuitry and levels of neurotransmitters like dopamine. Others think, yes, that's happening in the brain, but this is because through meditation we're linking to a consciousness greater than our own, which is what people in all religious traditions have thought it does. But without getting into that controversy, many people just meditate because it makes them feel better.
I'd like for you to try to explain, or I know you will explain, the concern people have that consciousness is more than a product of biochemical and electrical activities in the brain, and some people believe that it's a part of our natural human biology. And we spoke about the scientific reductionist view of consciousness, but for this conversation, what is the nature of consciousness from the vantage point of spiritual practice and meditation, and also some who experience this non-localized, pristine, and often luminous awareness that mystical traditions associate with consciousness will ascribe it to God or some kind of divine presence? How do you perceive consciousness from a stance that can be both scientific and spiritual simultaneously?
Well, it depends what philosophy of nature you start from. You see, if you take the materialist philosophy, which is really has become a kind of dogmatic belief system, that says there's no consciousness in the whole universe. Matter's unconscious and everything's made of matter. But then they have to admit that consciousness occurs in human brains, at least. But it's very hard to explain from the point of view of that philosophy, which is why the very existence of human consciousness is called the hard problem. Now, if you're a materialist, then you believe in advance that everything to do with consciousness is nothing but the brain, so there's nothing further to discuss. But if you don't accept the materialist philosophy, then there are a number of options. One is that panpsychism, which is the idea of a kind of mind or soul or consciousness in all nature, you know, in plants, in animals, in the earth, in the solar system, in the cosmos, that there's, we live in a living world with consciousness within it. And then there's the further view that, yes, that's true, but there's also a consciousness that transcends nature, which is an ultimate source of all things, which can be called God or Brahman or ultimate reality. Now, from that point of view, human consciousness is part of a vast conscious system, and through consciousness itself, we can connect with other forms of consciousness, more inclusive ones, which often give us a feeling of presence greater than human awareness, connection with a source of love or deep connectedness that goes beyond our normal state of mind. So it seems to me that that's the primary experience that underlies all religious traditions. I mean, the Buddha didn't become enlightened through doing a PhD. He became enlightened through sitting and meditating under trees. And Jesus didn't become aware of his mission and his connection, deep connection with God, through studying at a seminary. He got that through the direct experience at the moment of his baptism, then on his vision quest in the 40 days that followed it, fasting in the wilderness. So all religions, all mystical experience starts from experience, whereas the materialist view, which current science is based on, the current orthodoxy, starts from a theory that says the primary reality is unconscious and consciousness is a kind of illusion. Now, I think that you can believe that and still meditate. Indeed, many materialists and atheists do, in fact, meditate and still go on believing it's all in the brain. But I think the real and more scientific attitude is not to start from that dogma, but to start from the question of, well, what if consciousness is more extensive than the brain? What if there are these other forms of consciousness? What if the brain is the interface between our own consciousness and greater forms of consciousness that we can link to? What if that's the interface through which we affect the body and the senses and muscles and everything, and through which everything that happens in our body and our brain affects us as our conscious being? That it's an interface rather than simply something that's secreting consciousness as a kind of byproduct of physical activity. So in the end, the choice we have is whether we trust our own experience, if we have these experiences of connection with higher consciousness, or whether we prefer to trust a narrow, limited scientific dogma that consciousness doesn't really exist, or that if it does, it's just a product of brain activity that do anything. Now, the question really is whether we trust experience more than theory. And if we trust the theory more than experience, then we'd have to ask ourselves why. And I think that's a scientific question, because science is meant to be based on experience. It's empirical. Consciousness is the ultimate source of experience. That's what experience is. It happens in consciousness. So we can't rule out conscious experience as the basis of an empirical worldview. So I think another kind of science is possible. Indeed, it's already beginning to develop, one that treats conscious experiences as valid experiences for scientific investigation, rather than trying to reduce them all to the activity of brains. So I think it's all perfectly possible, and many people are already doing research within this post-materialist framework, a more holistic framework for science than mechanistic materialism.
I'd like to go a little further with that. Thank you for those insights. I appreciate them. There are some quantum physicists who are entertaining and suggesting that even electrons might have some kind of mind or consciousness. Can you go into this further, and why is it relevant for understanding the experiences we might have from doing a spiritual practice?
Well, I think the main reason that some physicists and a number of philosophers of mind, including Galen Strawson and Thomas Nagel, one of the leading philosophers of mind in the United States at Columbia, the reason that they're putting forward this panpsychist view, that the panpsychist means there's a kind of psyche or mind in all things or everywhere, they're considering, like some quantum physicists, that electrons might have some kind of mind or consciousness, or atoms might. The main impulse for thinking this is to try and explain the fact that we're conscious. If we're conscious, you see, which we are, then there are two possibilities. One is that consciousness just somehow emerges from material systems for no known reason, something totally different from matter, suddenly appears in human brains or in animal brains that get big enough out of an unconscious universe. That's one possibility, the materialist view. Or the possibility is there's some kind of primitive consciousness, even in electrons and atoms. So the emergence of consciousness in human minds is not a difference of kind, but a difference of degree from the nature of the rest of matter. And that's the motive for this panpsychist view, which attributes some level of consciousness to matter. So I personally think panpsychism is a new version of animism, the idea that nature's alive, and I have no problem with that. In fact, I think it's a much more reasonable view than the idea that it's all just an unconscious machine. So I think there's already a good philosophical reason, and quite a number of scientists are now considering panpsychism seriously. And I think this is actually where materialism is going right now. That's the current trend among the leaders of thought within the scientific world. Some of them still call it materialism. They just say they're broadening the definition of matter to include consciousness. But this is certainly not like old-style materialism. It's much more like animism. So panpsychism is a kind of bridge at the moment between old-school reductionist materialism, the kind we're all too familiar with, and a new kind of science.
Final short answer on this, please, because we're at the end of our program. Do we need a different kind of spirituality now, since so many religions are failing, so many young people are turning their backs on their parents' religions?
Well, I think we do. I think we need a spirituality that starts from experience, which comes through spiritual practice. And some people may then find, as I find myself, that these spiritual practices enable us to make more sense of traditional religious practices, which we can experience afresh if we see them as practices primarily about experience rather than things that are primarily to do with dogmas or beliefs.
Okay. By the way, you're making a very rare New York City appearance, giving a class and a full-day workshop at the U.S. At the Open Center at 30th and Madison Avenue, Manhattan, on November 9th, and intent to present all of his morphic resonance and philosophies as it applies to a variety of spiritual practices and for increasing our intuitive awareness about the world around us. For more information, just go to opencenter.org. And I wish you all the success. It's a rare treat for people to have a chance to hear you. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Gary, bye for now.
Dr. Rupert Sheldrake, I'm Gary Noll. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.